You are listening to the Experience Points IndieCast, episode number 4, for the week of June 22nd, 2011.
Welcome back to the Experience Points IndieCast. My name is George Albor.
I'm Scott Juster.
And we are the co-creators of ExperiencePoints.net, a site dedicated to the serious but not humorless analysis of video games and culture. But these days, we are also spending our time talking about indie games. This is our fourth episode, and we'll be talking about two games, both of which are free right now. You can play online, and we encourage you to do so before we ever start talking about them. The first game is called Sissy's Magical Ponycorn Adventure. And this game has gotten a lot of press, and we'll talk about some of that in the future. And the second game we'll be talking about is The Cat and the Coup. Two very similar games, I think, in many ways. But let's get into that right now. First up, Sissy's Magical Ponycorn Adventure.
Ponycorns. We should go over the morphology of ponycorns first.
So ponycorn is both a pony and a unicorn.
That's right. Magical.
So this game got a ton of notoriety recently. I think it came out about maybe like a month ago. Was that?
Yeah, about right? Roughly a month ago.
And, you know, most importantly, it got a lot of press. One, because it's incredibly cute, but mostly because it was created, ostensibly, in many ways at least, by a five-year-old child by the name of Cassie Creighton, I believe?
Creighton. Yeah.
So her dad, who's a indie developer in Toronto, went to Toe Jam, which was their sort of game jam, Toronto game jam, to create indie games. And he brought his five-year-old daughter, and she created some of the ideas, of course, behind Ponycorns. That wasn't his inspiration, I think. She did, yeah, most of the voice work. She plays Sissy, of course.
Yeah. Most of the artwork, too.
Yeah, and it's all crayons. So there's like a crayon rainbow, and like the ponycorns are clearly scribbles. It's a simple, it was developed in Unity. It's a simple like point and click adventure. What did you think about it?
Well, first of all, adorable, definitely. And it's nice to see, it's just nice to see that you know, dad and daughter are kind of creating something together that, you know, it's not like a magnum opus or anything, but it's a really functional game created within, you know, 48 hours or something like that.
Yeah, and he didn't take himself too seriously. It's not like, oh, I need to make this amazing game so my daughter's first game will be fantastic. Yeah. It's like, I want to make a game with her so that she can have made it, you know, and say that when she was just 5 years old, she helped develop a game.
Mm-hmm. It's also interesting that it is, like you said, it is a point-and-click adventure game. And I've read other things that Ryan has written on his blog, and I know he is a huge fan and was hugely influenced by the old Ron Gilbert adventure games. And so it is cool that he is kind of passing that stuff on to the next generation, like, firsthand. You know, she's definitely actually participating in making something like that.
Yeah, for sure. And, you know, as you mentioned, the game's not very long. It doesn't really have to be. But the puzzles are actually, you know, genuinely interesting. They're just kind of fun to do.
Yeah. And very, like, irreverent in the adventure game sense. You know, like, there are certain, like, you have to throw coconuts at people.
Specifically an evil lemon.
Yeah. I mean, like, there's that sense of silliness that is, you know, that you have to put together using, you know, the in-game logic to solve all the problems with.
Yeah. And there's like a sign that says, this sign shows a girl leaving to go get a coconut, which is, it's two things. One, it's sort of referential to the sort of help that old point-and-click adventures would try to give you now and again. And two, it's just super cute and esoteric and really bizarre to have inside the game.
Yeah.
I also think it's funny that all of the art is basically cut out paper that she drew on and then was scanned into the game. And it's so funny to me that the aesthetics of that aren't actually that far away from some other indie games that people take very seriously that are basically, you know, they're not childish, but they're super simple. Sometimes they're even just cut out paper. And I think it's so funny that it's in the same vein, but so, I mean, not juvenile in the negative sense, but it's a children's drawing, you know.
Well, there is a certain amount of authenticity that you get when you actually have someone who's 5 years old, coloring and cutting out the stuff that you don't get when Nintendo throws $10 million at making Paper Mario or something like that.
Yeah, exactly, exactly.
And it's something that is neat to see being created and polished within a game jam, because, you know, like one of the drawbacks of game jams is that sometimes things don't come out as complete as they might. Mm-hmm. And this feels like a really self-contained, polished game.
Why do you think that the game was so popular? Like, it's crazy. It was on major news sites. It was all over the gaming press.
And also now, I mean, he's been able to parlay it into, you know, shirts and toys and buttons and stuff like that. I mean, you know, he's made probably a couple thousand dollars on the game so far.
Well, he's made, I actually wrote this down, he's already made $2,838 in just donations.
Yeah.
All of which is going to Cassie's education fund.
Yeah. And I think that's one of the reasons why something like this catches on, because there is a heartwarming story behind it.
Yeah.
And it's something different. And also, really, like, you know, we just came out of E3 where we were bombarded by pretty much all balding, gruff space marines shooting at people.
Yeah.
And it's a palate cleanser to have something like this come along when the mainstream is very focused on a dominant idea.
Yeah, it's very inspiring. I mean, especially for it feels like it's a hugely sort of a badge of the democracy of game development. Mm-hmm. You know, like, we can say, look, this 5-year-old girl helped make this game, and it was incredibly popular. Let's make other 5-year-old girls make it. Well, let's not make them make it.
Let's lock them all in a room.
Yeah, the children game jam. let's help people make games, and it doesn't matter their age, it doesn't matter their gender. Like, let's make really cool, fun stuff because people like to tell stories.
Yeah, I mean, all of this is kind of this is a really feel good story. But I dug around on his website a little bit more, and he's been quite upfront and quite vocal about the trials of being an independent developer, especially in the Flash scene right now, in the Flash market. Mm-hmm. I mean, by far as I can tell from his past posts, this is by far his most profitable game.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, after he kind of went independent and started making his own games, he started charting out the dollars per hour he was making when submitting games to places like Kongregate and other large Flash sites. And it was less than a dollar an hour. Like, it was sweat. Yikes. It was sweatshop labor. Wages. Mm-hmm. And his whole point was that you only hear of the huge successes of people in these booming markets like Flash and iPhone and everything like that. Mm-hmm. But the vast majority of the people just can't make a living off of this.
Yeah.
And this is all kind of it's weird that he has now become an overnight sensation after kind of going into quite deeply how being an overnight sensation is the exception rather than the rule.
Yeah. That's a little sad, I guess.
It is sad, but if you want to take a less depressing look at it, you have to start asking questions about, you know, why do people make games? I mean, and we ask ourselves this as writers, because writers face the same thing on the internet. Mm-hmm. Like, you either have to be extremely good and getting paid well for what you do, or you have to just really love it.
Right.
Because there's so much that you just won't get. You'll never make a profit off of this. Like, we've been running this website for a long time. We've been running this podcast for a long time. We're very much in the red.
Right.
I mean, we don't spend any money on it, but any money we do spend is never recouped.
Right.
So it's like this is like... making games is a similar thing. Like he's clearly doing this out of, well, one, it's what he wants to be doing with his life, but two, he's clearly dedicated to it because it's not a profitable thing.
Yeah, and we never really expect, you know, it's not like all game designers should be making a living from making the craziest indie games. I mean, some of them just aren't going to be successful. That's, you know, the trials and tribulations of any industry, really, but in particular, the entertainment industry. I still think the story is, I mean, like you're saying, it's about having a love for what you do, and I think it's still a really powerful story having this child be clearly into it. Mm-hmm. I think you can tell it in her voice acting, but there's some videos online where she talks about it or what have you.
Yeah.
You know, it's clear that she had a really good time, engage with this progress. And I think that maybe it's a good reminder to other game designers who are much, much older than Cassie that, you know, there is something super awesome about, super, super magical about game design, you know?
Yeah. I mean, if I took a look at the donations page, and I noticed one of the highest donators out there was someone mysteriously named Cow Clicker, and I followed the links all the way back, and it actually went back to Cow Clicker. So if you're able to melt the icy, curmudgeonly heart of Ian Bogost, then you're clearly doing something right.
Yeah, I think that he got like three more years added to his life just out of the magical adventure. I want to talk about a couple things that aren't as magical.
All right, let's do it.
And I haven't seen a lot of people talk about this, but have you ever seen that documentary, My Kid Could Paint That?
No, but I have heard of it. Go ahead and explain
so
it, though.
So the basic idea of this film is that a child painted these, she painted these paintings that were similar to, like, Pollock, right? Almost like splatter paintings. They weren't rainbows. They were just sort of, what is it called, impressionist?
It's like the stereotypical, I thought it was, like, modern art, but what was it, impressionist?
I don't recall exactly. That's not entirely the point. The point is that this child, she was only maybe like 10, maybe even younger than that, 8 to 10, made these paintings, and they were sold for a ton of money. And she became incredibly popular, and people really wanted to own her paintings. And then things slowly started to come out that maybe she didn't paint these at all. Maybe her parents painted them. Was there ever a moment when you were at least first playing this game that you thought maybe that was the situation? You know, maybe this was a sort of ploy to get people to fall in love with it. I'm not saying that's what it is.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm saying is...
trying to gauge my cynicism.
Yeah, well, yeah. And I think there was a moment where I had that feeling. Because this is not a story that we see a lot.
That's true. It is very rare. And it was very much... Like, this is bait for people like us. You know, like, this is gaming intelligentsia catnip. You know, like, this is something that we, you know, as, like... people that, you know, consider themselves kind of in the know about the medium, I feel like they are people that are taken in by this sort of thing. Like, could this be a Pixel Vixen 707 type deal?
Right,
you know?
Right.
Actually, before I played the game, I kind of thought it might be that. Like, I thought it was an indie developer who did this style on purpose and was kind of doing it as a joke. Mm-hmm. And then once I dug around on the website a little bit, I came to the conclusion that either it's the most elaborate hoax I've ever seen, or Cassie's actually a real person.
Right. Yeah. I mean, don't get me wrong. I want to say that I don't believe for a second that the story is not true. Mm-hmm. Just that this is something that we've encountered in other mediums. And I think that's a kind of an interesting question to ask, especially in light of my second question, which is this a repeatable success?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Could this be spun out into a genre of kid-created, adult-facilitated games?
I mean, does the charm wear off? Like, I'm sure we would be happy to play Cassie's next game.
Yeah,
But, you know...
Only if it has a physics engine.
But, you know, is this a fluke? Is this something that can be repeatable? You know, like we said, the game is not exactly like the creme de la creme. It is super good for what it is.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I mean, it's a question of whether something like this can exist outside of a game jam type environment. Because, I mean, like, we're looking at it as, like, this is an accomplishment because it's a challenge based on how fast and how polished you can make something, not, you know, take all the time you need, and then we'll see what the final product is.
Yeah.
And so I would be interested to see if Ryan or anyone else would be interested in making a more long form version of this, or just, you know, letting a group of kids make something and see what comes of that.
Yeah. There are youth produced games, you know, most commonly amongst like high school students and whatnot. Mm-hmm. But like 5 year olds. But that's a great question. Like an hour-long Sissy's Magical Pony Corner adventure. Like, what would that be like? Would that be as well received?
Well, I mean, maybe we can get him to institute a downloadable content scheme. And if we pre-order it, we can get the orange pony corn for free.
Sweet. That does sound magical.
I don't know. I think this is a really cool... This is a feel-good story. I liked it a lot.
Definitely. I highly encourage everyone to play it because it's absolutely adorable.
Yeah.
Why am I saying super all the time, by the way? That's a terrible idea. real quick, favorite quote from the game? That's a goat on a pole. Weird.
Yeah. I kept on running into that cactus a bunch of times.
Yeah.
Because I just thought there might be something to do with it. And it was like, ow, that cactus is sharp. And I was like, yes, that is. Must be something to do with this here, so I just kept on like clicking on it like crazy.
I did get stuck. I got stuck where like I didn't realize I had to click on the tiger to ask him to close his eyes.
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
Well, you could call the game helpline. You could set up a 900 number where Cassie can help you like make your way through like pro tips, like the old Nintendo style version.
Okay, moving on. A game that in some ways is similar to Sissy's Magical Pony Corner Adventure, The Cat and the Coup, which is about the CIA coup of Mohammad Mossadegh, the first democratically elected prime minister of Iran.
Yep, a little bit of a gear shift here, huh, folks?
Yeah. So this is a documentary game by Peter Brinson and Kurash Volanejad, as well as a few others. It is minimally interactive. It's a puzzle game, I would say. There's about four puzzles in it. Mm-hmm. And it kind of goes over some of the history of Mossadegh and his fall.
Mm-hmm.
What did you think of this game?
You know, before I even played this game, before I knew what I was getting into, I decided that I really needed to refresh myself on some contemporary Middle East politics, because mm-hmm. I started trying to dredge up everything I knew about the coup and also the 51 nationalization of their oil. And right. I was like, oh, well, I am a terrible world citizen. Like, I can only remember a little bit about this. So I spent a little while actually kind of following the links around the internet and reading various reviews of books about it and watching a few videos and just to kind of prepare myself for what I may or may not experience in the game.
Uh-huh.
Which was a weird prelude to the game itself. Like, I probably spent more time researching the actual event than I did playing the game.
It's so funny that you did that too, because you know, ostensibly this is a documentary game to get people to do what you did.
Yeah.
But after they play the game.
Well, we'll get to this in a little bit, but I did do it after I played the game too, but in a different way.
Okay.
But anyway, okay, let's go into it. Cat and the Coup. I thought that it, again, like you were saying, it's somewhat of an adventure game. It's somewhat of a kind of a physics puzzle game a little mm-hmm. bit. And you play as this cat that is following Mossadegh around, you know, various rooms of this magical kind of dreamscape mm-hmm. throughout various points in his life. And you need to solve puzzles to get to the next section of the game. I thought the artwork was strikingly beautiful. Like, I didn't expect gorgeous. That at all.
Yeah.
And it's not, I'm not trying to say that, you know, indie games are ugly or I have low expectations for them. What I'm trying to say is that I was like, this surpassed anything that I had expected.
Yeah. And beautifully put together, because the art that they choose is not always of the same style. You know, there's a lot of Middle Eastern paintings and etchings, but then there's also, you know, cut and paste images of bulldogs and peacocks and hand-drawn aspects, and they're all just beautifully composited.
It's kind of like a collage, like a magazine collage, but taking pictures from, you know, medieval Middle East and then, you know, 1950s pop culture and then postmodern stuff, and just kind of pasting and smashing it all together to make this really neat collage that I feel like if you could zoom all the way out, it would look like a portrait or something.
Right.
So anyway, that was superficial, true, but I think there's a lot of imagery and messages bound up in that imagery, as far as, you know, the British bulldog to represent Churchill and the peacock to represent the Shah. Like, you know, the Shah is someone who's flashy but doesn't really do anything, and so like right. he's represented as a peacock throughout the game, which is I thought was kind of neat. It's a nice metaphor.
Yeah. And the rabbit who is presumably Truman.
Yeah. Uh huh. I was trying to figure out the lizard who is the one that kind of sets the coup in motion throughout, and you know I'm thinking that it might be Kermit Roosevelt,
the CIA
yeah
I think almost certainly yeah
I'm trying to figure out if there's a reason why it was a lizard, like if there's something about him, or if it was just meant to be kind of like a cold-blooded type creature.
Oh, that's, yeah, that's good.
But I mean, I don't know enough about Kermit Roosevelt Jr. to know anything about like why he might be represented that way. Let's see. I've been talking a lot. You should say something, George. I don't know what.
Sure. Well, I mean, it's hard because I kind of want to get into the ideas of the game.
Me too.
But I don't want to skip over the game as its own sort of contained experience.
Yeah, let's talk about the puzzles then.
So when I went to this Asian American Film Festival and I saw Peter Brinson talk briefly about the game, he mentioned he lowered and was lowering the difficulty of the game as he was creating it.
Mm-hmm.
And the game isn't very hard. Where you need to be as the cat is very outlined. There are a few moments when I got a little bit stuck, was wondering, well, you know, what do I have to do in this particular situation? But for the most part, it's just, it almost feels like the puzzles are designed to just keep you in the room and think on what's going on.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of the puzzles are just as good metaphors as the art in the background.
Yeah.
You know, in one, you have, there's a, in one puzzle, Truman, who's dressed as this rabbit, is sort of preventing Mossadegh from falling off his chair.
Mm-hmm.
And as the cat, you kind of knock at this oil lantern and oil falls and makes Mossadegh slip off his chair and move more towards his fate.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, that's a fantastic metaphor in puzzle form.
Mm-hmm.
As the cat itself, I don't know how your own actions really contribute to that. It's more like you're playing through the extended metaphor that is the game.
Yeah. And I mean, as the cat, it's kind of a late game reveal that the cat is a representative of subterfuge.
Right.
Because the British bulldog, you know, gives this cat to the lizard, and then the mm-hmm. lizard releases it into Mossadegh's life. And so, you know, you are playing through unwittingly as the saboteur for most of the game.
Yeah.
And yeah, I like that oil puzzle quite a bit. It took a little bit to figure out what was going on. There were some things where some of it is strangely physics based. I mean, a lot of it is like leaning towards one direction of the room to make things slide and then leaning back to make a door open up in the other direction.
Which is, I mean, that's again, like in terms of metaphors and whatnot, like the sort of the teetering position that Mossadegh is in this really dangerous situation in the 1950s, I think is well reflected by that act.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I was thinking about all of this stuff because I got to the point where, you know, if you have a puzzle like this, and this is a question for the game creator as well, is there a danger of having the puzzle prohibit someone's progress through the game, especially if you're trying to impart a message?
Right.
And well, for us, like, we both made it through the game just fine. And was there a point where you caught yourself thinking about the puzzle more so than the message of the game, or did you feel like those things were complementary?
I mean, they were mostly complementary. There were a couple where, you know, I wasn't sure if I was doing the right thing. There's one puzzle where you knock like a ball off of a string and you get him to hop on it, and I wasn't sure if I was making him fall off of that ball in the right location in the room. Mm-hmm. People who've played will know generally what I'm talking about.
Yeah.
And so, but, you know, after trial and error, you'll get to the solution eventually. Most of the situations, you know, they're well telegraphed and they aren't particularly difficult to understand. And even if you don't understand them, you could still succeed.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you might not understand, well, why is this leading me to the next room? But after a while, he'll just fall through the floor, for example. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. The same goes for the very last puzzle where you jump on him and he sort of punctures the ground and oil shoots up.
Mm-hmm.
But it was never so difficult as to take me away from the sort of scenery.
Mm-hmm. Do you think that there are certain aspects of the adventure genre that lend themselves better to things like this? I mean, like even Ponycorns was an adventure game as well, and there's kind of this message about creation and the power of that. I mean, is there something about adventure games that lends themselves well to being message focused experiences?
Would you call Cat in the Coup an adventure game?
I think it is. I mean, there's no like they are basically puzzles.
Yeah.
And some of it is timing based, I guess, but I mean it's there's no fail state.
Yeah.
Like a lot of adventure games, you know, it's just a matter of doing something correctly rather than avoiding failure.
Yeah. You know, no, not, I don't think so inherently. I kind of talked on about this subject, I think it was a while ago, maybe like almost 6 weeks by now, in an article I wrote for Pop Matters, on the fate of documentary games, mm-hmm. in which I was kind of suggesting that, documentary games are in a really difficult position where they want to avoid historical revisionism, but in order to do so, they have to confine interactivity.
Mm-hmm.
And I think The Cat and the Coup reflects that dilemma perfectly because, you know, one, the game's relatively easy. So, and like you said, the adventure games don't have a lot of fail states. So it lends itself well to a sort of a good pacing for you. You know, it's easy to make sure everyone's moving through history at the pace that they should be moving through history. And the other thing is that you're not playing as most deck. There's nothing you can do to stop his downfall. Mm-hmm. You know, history is already set in stone. So mm-hmm. what's the point of making a game that is deeply interactive but also trying to be a documentary? I don't know what that would look like.
Yeah, and that's kind of what I was getting at. I mean, is there something about the format that lends itself to the gravity of going through the past? I mean, like, maybe you might, but are there documentary games that are structured as platformers, you know, where something that we kind of associate with innate silliness, does it detract from the seriousness of what someone's trying to communicate when they talk about a history game?
So there are actually very few documentary games. You know, like there's a genre of like news games, for example, that could potentially be considered documentary in some way. But I think that there's a distinct separation between the two. Mm-hmm. And of the documentary games that I'm aware of, none of them attach themselves to sort of like silly platformer like mechanics.
Yeah.
The one, I forget what it's called, but there's a game about specifically about a case, I think it was in Kentucky, where some teens were convicted of killing somebody, and they were sent to jail and put through the judicial system. And the game is about that process and the killing and how that affected the community. And you play the game as a documentary is playing on the right. So it's interactive, minimally so, but it's still interactive without breaking the documentary format, because you literally have a documentary playing right next to you.
Hmm.
You know, so I could see a situation where the sort of platform that you're talking about or other genres besides adventure could be used in conjunction with a documentary to tell a sort of documentary story.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't see how the mechanics themselves can contribute very well to that.
I was trying to think of examples about this, and like one of the games I kept coming back to was, and this is not about history, this is more like about literature, is Braid.
Mm-hmm.
'Cause like Braid has game dynamics that are generally thought of as kind of lighthearted and silly, you know, jump on things to kill them and go through pipes and stuff like that. But it's all kind of in service of this larger theme of memory and progress.
Yeah, but that's the distinct point there, right? Like the mechanics are in service of a theme, not a rendering of history.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You know? It's something that I was thinking about a lot, because the other thing that comes to mind when I think of games about history or the real world are games that I kind of consider to be playing with what some people call historical forces, mm-hmm. like Civilization or The Sims or something like that. Like games that try to model things like population growth or political turmoil rather than specific events in our history.
And I definitely condone those types of games. I think there's a lot of value in playing a game that helps you understand a historical system that existed at that time period. You know, mm-hmm. like something like Train, right? Brenda Brathwaite's Train models a system that was very important in a historical time period, that of taking Jews en masse to concentration camps. But that's not a documentary game. It's not about the trains going to concentration camps. It's not about World War II, and it's not a documentary game specifically about the Holocaust. It's about the system that existed in that time period. That could shed a lot of light on the events of history, but it won't take you through a sort of formal path through history in order to understand it, you know? Mm-hmm. But again, maybe I'm wrong. There are a lot of different ways we can imagine documentaries going, and there's a lot of strange documentaries that exist in film and other mediums. So I can imagine someone making a great documentary game that is deeply interactive. I just don't know what that will look like. You know, that's an innovation that I can't grasp quite yet.
Well, I mean, the problem with interactivity is that it's inherently based on systems, and in the history profession, there are a school of people that are very wary about having theories or models to take a look at history, because, you know, there's that old phrase, like, if the only tool you have is a hammer, then all of life's problems look like nails.
Yeah.
And so if you are someone that always is going to look at something from a political lens or an economic lens, then you run the danger of kind of applying economic determinism to every situation you examine, even if there are other explanations for it.
Right.
And so you have this whole, you know, we've gone through this. We've had multiple schools of thought, especially in American history, that kind of churn and fight for dominance. You know, some people think that everything's economic determinism. Some people argue that there's like a broad consensus, a broad liberal consensus throughout American history. But all of these problems stem from people having specific models as to how they look at the past.
Yeah.
And so something like Civilization or The Sims, as opposed to a documentary game, can run that same risk. You know, whoever programmed, and you've written about this extensively when you were talking about Civilization, like whoever programmed Civilization programs it in with a certain model of looking at how humans work, and that model dictates the messages you take out from the game.
And I think that's exactly why, you know, systems literacy or systems fluency is so important, right? Because you can take Civilization into a classroom, for example, and say, well, let's look at what economic determinism means for people who believe in this ideology, for people who believe in this theory, right? Mm-hmm. What does the world look like with this particular lens? And now, because it's a game, let's take off that lens and move to a different game with a different lens. You know, that could be really useful. But the danger is when you're entering a system where you don't know the underlying principles, and you presume that this is sort of how history is made. And to kind of go back to Cat and the Coup, this game is not didactic. I really don't think that it is trying to convince you one way or the other. All of the events, like the blurbs, the quotes, the sound, even some of the audio files, are actual government documents.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so I don't know. Maybe you have a different opinion. Do you think this game is didactic in any way?
Certain choices are made that present the story in a specific way. Like after I finished the game, I actually went through and started kind of taking a glance at the primary sources they were using to tell the story. And you know, a good example of the problems and the dangers of just kind of looking at a documentary as just facts is the Time magazine. In 1951, Mohammad Mossadegh was named Man of the Year.
Mm-hmm.
And
Slobodan Milosevic was named Man of the Year at one point as well.
And that's the point. Like, people think that Time's Man of the Year is always a good thing, but often they pick people that you know, they are just important to the world.
Right. Stalin was the Man of the Year once.
But the trick was, in the game, it was presented as, oh, wow, like America and Truman in general seem to be actually kind of behind this guy. Mm-hmm. But if you actually go and read the 1951 Time Man of the Year article, you have this sense that Time is writing about Mossadegh as if he is Iran's George Washington. But they say that kind of wistfully and sadly, because they actually are very disparaging of him. You know, they look at him as kind of effeminate and weak and a potential victim of communist influence. They say, you know, but in terms of Asian realities, the Lafayette Washington picture, and they're relating that to the you know, French and American relationship during the Revolution,
right.
The Lafayette Washington picture was sheer sentimentality between, you know, Iran and America. And like all sentimentality, it led to bad morals. Like they're saying that Mohammad Mossadegh is Iran's George Washington. And that's a bad thing because he's actually a pretty bad George Washington. Like they criticize him for leading his country and the world down a path that is probably going to be bad for everybody, which is nationalizing the oil. And so it's not like they're lionizing him as a hero. Mm-hmm. They're kind of just saying that this person is very important and he is this country's revolutionary, but he's not someone to be admired. And it's actually a shame we have to deal with him.
This is a fantastic point. And I think that, you know, in some ways it offers a counterpoint to the idea that, well, true documentaries should not be interactive. Because in some ways, at least an interactive documentary in terms of if we're looking at systems, you can interrogate it in some way. You could make tests. You could push back against mm-hmm. the system that they model. There's not much, there's no pushback in this.
Yeah. But unless you want to dig into it, which you can, you just have to kind of... You have to want to do that. It's not going to be very apparent once you finish the game. And, you know, I don't mean this to say that the game is inaccurate, obviously. Like, I am no expert in Middle East history, but
yeah.
from the research that I have done, this game tends to hew very closely to what most of the experts say about the time. And, like, there are primary source documents out there that you can read. Like, The Times is all online, and... you know, there have been CIA documents that have been released in the subsequent years that kind of back up the story this game is putting forth.
Yeah.
This whole thing reminded me of this radio show that I was listening to a while back. It's called This American Life.
Yeah.
Woo. And I mean, I have a very complicated relationship with This American Life, but I listen to it anyway. There was one episode where someone did a story about a group of kids that went to the Ronald Reagan Museum.
Yes, this is what I wrote about in my documentary game.
Yeah, and it was something that I was reminded of, your post and the Ronald Reagan thing, when I was playing this game, because at the Ronald Reagan Library, kids are allowed to kind of recreate the invasion of Grenada in 1983 as if they were making the choices that Reagan was facing. Mm-hmm. And it's very much, it's more interactive than this game in a way, because they have a choice as to what to do rather than just to move it on to the next phase in the timeline.
But it, okay, continue, sorry.
They couch it as if, you know, there's no right or wrong answers, but the kids are rewarded when they choose what Reagan chose, and the kids are kind of punished with a buzzer and a more detailed explanation of why Reagan chose this thing when they counter his choices.
And in a communal setting, public shame for being wrong.
Exactly. I mean, there are clearly right answers, even if they're not couched as right answers, which is, even though they are talking about the facts of history, they are putting a value judgment in that these facts of history were the best way that it could have turned out.
And that's the dangerous, that's the most dangerous and frightening aspect of that story is the illusion of choice, right? You get this idea that things could have been different, and people would not have had to have lost their lives in this situation. And you don't get that. Like, things couldn't, the only way that things could have been different, according to the people who run the Reagan Library, is if the press hadn't informed the public of an illegal act.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, it sets up this, it sets up this idea in the kids' head about having an adversarial relationship with the press and about government influence and privilege as far as keeping secrets goes, that impart a lot of values that are dressed up in the guise of being on the right side of history.
Right.
And something like The Cat and the Coup is able to avoid that problem by taking away that revisionist history, that taking away like the counterfactual possibility of history.
Yeah.
Just kind of leading you through the events that happened and creating a metaphor for how things were happening with the cat and having you kind of push forward the events of the story that they're trying to tell.
So do you think that the game could have been, I don't want to say better, but do you think that you would have enjoyed or it could have gotten across the same message if you could have played as Mossadegh himself mm-hmm. in certain puzzles, or maybe played as some of the mob that took him over, or the CIA? Or any of the other sort of main characters in history.
I mean, as a video game player, I think it might have been more interesting to see if you can kind of maximize those systems or find a way around that problem. But as a historian, I'm really apprehensive about counterfactual history. Like, it's fun to read, like, oh, what if the Nazis won? You know, that stuff is entertaining, but it's a really dangerous road to go down because that stuff just didn't happen.
Right.
And it's better to learn the lessons of why things did happen rather than focus your time on why things didn't happen, because that's always, you're searching for a negative rather than constructing something.
I think in some ways the game does invite players to think about a counterfactual history, you know, one in which Mossadegh was not ousted from government. I don't think that the game does it with any blunt force, but specifically, Peter Brinson mentions on their website that the game is designed to get people to think about their relationship with Mossadegh, whether or not they knew they had one.
Mm-hmm. Right?
And I think it does draw connections between the 1953 coup and, you know, current modern day politics. You know, Iran is big in the media today, and you know, it's a counterfactual, but in some ways, we want to say if it wasn't for Mossadegh's coup, we might not have the sort of authoritarian theocracy we kind of see today in Iran, right?
Well, you can flip that sentiment so it's not counterfactual. I mean, you can say that, you know, play through this game and it will give you a sense of how much he was facing, like how much outside influence he had to deal with during his short tenure. And then you can say, because of this outside influence, this is still one of the sources of lingering resentment of the West in the Middle East.
Right.
Like, there's nothing wrong with saying that. Like, that's a pretty safe statement to make. Like, there is a lot of resentment because there is a long history of meddling.
Yeah.
And with deadly results. And so, like, you can say that without saying that if that never happened, the Middle East would be a paradise. It's a safer statement to say that because this happened, there is a continued history of resentment here.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. I think I really enjoyed where the game ended with his death. But I almost kind of wish that it had been more blunt about the sort of long-term effects of his fall. You know, like, the Shah was ousted in 79 in an incredibly bloody revolution in Iran. Mm-hmm. And that's not specifically mentioned in the game anywhere. Nor is the Ayatollah Khomeini's takeover in what, 79 or 80.
Mm-hmm.
And I think in some ways it might have been nice to couch the events of the Cat and the Coup in an even greater historical narrative.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, it's definitely focused on Mossadegh personally. You know, like a pretty much a forgotten history, you know, a forgotten leader in history.
Amongst the West. I mean, certainly in Iran, he's still very remembered.
Exactly. And like you saw during the revolutions that just happened last year or a year and a half ago, people take to the streets and you see pictures of him. You get a sense of that when the game ends and it kind of sweeps over the swath of time that you had played through. I mean, you see, I really like the image of the students whose heads are books, throwing books at the army.
Yeah.
Which is a pretty sad image, really.
And you see books burning nearby.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, like, they had no tools to fight the enemies that they were trying to fight, and yet they were trying to do it anyway.
Yeah, with knowledge. And I mean, a lot of students lost their lives.
Yeah. And so that stuff is all very implicit and kind of and conveyed emotionally.
Mm-hmm.
And it's, I think what you're saying is true. Like, this could be expanded. Like, if you wanted to expand this documentary, you can take it all the way up to the 80s. You take it all the way up to the 21st century if you want to. But like, as a single episode, I liked what happened. If anything, I would have liked a longer section of him in prison and under house arrest.
Yeah, some of his writings as well would have been interesting to include.
Yeah, because it's a very sad existence, you know? I mean, he was imprisoned in 53 and, you know, for a few years, and then was confined to house arrest for, you know, until until his death, you know, which was years and years.
And, you know, we laugh about, you know, Martha Stewart being under house arrest a few years ago, but it's not a good fate, you know, and like, he was completely isolated from the world. And for a thinker, you know, that's...
Especially in the 60s, especially in Iran, like, it's much harder to... And especially after he has, after he had tried to really do right by his country, as far as most people are concerned, as far as personally I'm concerned, is my bias showing through? I mean, it's
definitely,
it's really, it's hard to have very much sympathy at all for the British in this case.
Yeah. Yeah. Like, as you're saying, and you know, to join your bias with mine, this is a story about a tragedy, and it's pretty rare to be able to sort of be involved with something like this in a game format. And I thought it was absolutely fascinating.
Yeah, same here. I would be interested to see more of more games that do this rather than like the system-based stuff.
Yeah.
Because I think it is inherently, it's inherently linear and probably in that case less interesting to people because there's less agency involved. But I do think it is truer to a more pure form of history.
Yeah, and I think that, you know, we might not, like you said, we might not have the sort of agency we've come to expect. It's maybe it's not advancing the medium of games as games, but I think there's a lot of value in an experience like this. And I agree. I would love to see more.
All right. Well, we started with Ponycorns. We ended with Evil Cats.
Yep.
Both adventure games, though, which I still think is quite interesting as far as the adventure game, the utility of the adventure or at least point and click genre.
Well, you know, Sissy's like, what, she's going to be six soon. She'll learn about Native Americans.
Oh, man.
Maybe we can get a documentary game about the Trail of Tears.
Unless there's some Ponycorns that come save the day, I'm really going to have to steel myself against a game like that. That'll be a rough one.
That's pretty dark. I apologize.
you shouldn't though, because people need to play these games, Ponycorns or not. And we'll definitely add links into the show notes. You know, both games can be played in 15 minutes, so there's really and on almost any machine as well. So there's a really good opportunity to play them.
Yeah, absolutely.
All right. If you want to write in with your suggestions or your comments, experiencepoints@gmail.com is our email address.
We also encourage you to leave your thoughts on both of these games in the comment section. We definitely look forward to hearing your thoughts on both games, really. We'd also love to hear your suggestions about any indie titles that you think we should check out. We especially some of the newer ones, but you know, there's a lot out there, so let us know. Experiencepoints.net is the site.
Until next time, everyone. Take it easy.
Bye-bye. Every time